Good evening. Cuomo announces his guide to reopening New York, homeless people on the subways as hunger stalks America. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with some of the news for Tuesday, April 28th, 2020. In Latin America news, after a two-year trial, an Argentine court Monday sentenced 28 former military personnel to life in prison for crimes against humanity. The crimes occurred during a military dictatorship that ruled the South American country from 1976 until 1983. Of the 272 victims, 133 three are still missing, 28 bodies were located, and 111 were released after being illegally detained. The dirty war in Argentina was part of a right-wing plot called Operation Condor, occurring throughout the continent, where death squads disappeared at least 30,000 left-wing activists. And nine inmates have died after a prison riot in Peru over demands for better sanitary measures and coronavirus medical care. That's according to the country's prison authority. Peru approved a decree last week that allows President Martin Vizcarra to grant humanitarian pardons to prisoners to prevent the spread of coronavirus in the country's jails. Peru's jails are currently at more than double capacity. And Brazil's Supreme Court has ordered an investigation against President Jair Bolsonaro. Brazil's former minister, Justice Minister Sergio Moro, resigned from his post last Friday and accused Bolsonaro of interfering in police investigations. The opposition Workers' Party made a criminal complaint to the court yesterday, accusing Bolsonaro of corruption. And in Chile, a nation convulsed by protests for the past year, police finally suppressed a demonstration in the capital, Santiago, on Monday, where participants wore masks and practiced social distancing. The demonstration targeted police accused of human rights violations and featured participants banging pots and pans. They were met with a barrage of tear gas and water cannons. Local media reported about 30 arrests, including a young boy who had lost his eye to a police rubber bullet last year and became an international voice for the social unrest in Chile. And a former United Nations aid chief who now heads the Norwegian Refugee Council says economic sanctions against Syria, Iran, and Venezuela must be suspended during the coronavirus pandemic. Jan Egeland said that despite exemptions for medical and food supplies, aid groups still face hurdles helping vulnerable peoples during the health crisis. And the epicenter of the pandemic has settled on New York City. Although the curve of increasing hospitalizations have flattened, the New York region is still suffering high death rates from the disease. But with pressure from the White House for states to back off stringent lockdowns, even Governor Andrew Cuomo is outlining a plan for reopening the state.
We want to reopen, but we want to do it without infecting more people or overwhelming the hospital system. We're at Upstate Medical today. Our great fear was the number of people infected would overwhelm the hospital capacity. So that's the balance. Reopen, but don't increase the number of infected people and don't overwhelm the hospital system. Well, then design that system in reopening, right? You can factually, with data, design a system that does just that. And that's what government is supposed to do. We're adopting a set of rules, a set of guidelines. If the hospital system in an area exceeds 70% capacity, or the rate of transmission of the virus hits 1.1, those are danger signs. If the transmission rate hits 1.1, that's what they call outbreak. That means it's going to spread much, much faster. You wouldn't start reopening unless you had a transmission rate below 1.1, really below 1. But if it hits 1.1, that means you're in trouble.
Cuomo said manufacturing and construction jobs will be the first businesses to return to work, as well as parts of upstate New York, that have not been heavily impacted. But Cuomo added it would take a miracle for New York City to reopen by May 15th. And New York City remains in virtual lockdown as the mayor agreed to a city council proposal prohibiting traffic on 40 miles of city streets to help social distancing. Subway traffic is already down by 90%. That despite the early completion of repairs on the Canarsie Tunnel, damaged by flooding in 2012 during Superstorm Sandy. The tunnel is used by the L train. But with subway use down, many of the city's thousands of homeless people have been moving in. Cuomo responded to an article in today's New York Daily News showing people sprawled on subway benches piled high with belongings. He said it was disrespectful to essential workers who ride the trains.
Disgusting what is happening on those subway cars. It's disrespectful to the essential workers who need to ride the subway system. Upstate New York need to ride the buses to get to work. They deserve better and they will have better. We have to have a public transportation system that is clean, where the trains are disinfected. You have homeless people on trains. It's not even safe for the homeless people to be on trains. No face masks. You have this whole outbreak. We're concerned about homeless people, so we let them stay on the trains without protection in this epidemic of the COVID virus? No, we have to do better than that, and we will.
But homeless activists say the reason people are living on the subway is because the government has failed, and people should be given a bed instead of being arrested or kicked out of the system onto the street. Coalition for the Homeless Policy Director is Giselle Ruthier. She says shelters are disease incubators and are not an option.
I mean, it's completely out of line. It's not approaching it from the perspective of the person who is homeless and is fearful for their lives entering a congregate shelter, because that's the only option that's being offered to people who are homeless right now. What we need both the city and state to do is prioritize homeless people on the streets and in the subways immediately for access to hotel rooms, because they are unable to appropriately social distance, unable to take care of their basic needs like showering and washing their hands and getting clothing and food because of the lack of options in the city right now that so many things have closed. We need to be taking care of our homeless New Yorker neighbors, and that means offering them a really safe option and not vilifying them.
What would happen if the police started enforcing, you know, no sleeping on the subway rules at this time? I mean, what would that, where would they put these people if they're not putting them in hotel rooms and the shelters are dangerous? Where do they go?
So you'd have the officer interacting with a homeless person, possibly without the appropriate social distancing, a person possibly facing a summons or an arrest, summons that they can't pay, an arrest and sent to jail where there absolutely is no social distancing and the exposure to the virus would be worse. Or we could have somebody who just moved along and moved to a different place and is harder to find, harder to reach, harder to approach with a real solution when and if that actually comes along. For people that are sick already, I mean, that's just detrimental to their health. It's detrimental to everyone else's health. So that's not the appropriate way to go about helping people who are homeless.
How has the Cuomo administration been on homelessness?
We look at the numbers. You know, the number of people who are homeless has absolutely skyrocketed under Governor Cuomo. We have more homeless people now than we've had almost ever before, particularly homeless single adults. And as we're facing this virus, we're now seeing a new cohort of people becoming newly homeless who've never been homeless before, who have lost unstable housing, who have lost jobs, who have been sickened. We need our elected officials, mayor, governor, federal government, to actually be focusing on housing solutions so that we can have safe places for people to go and remain permanently and be housed, so that we're not facing this dilemma and this unsafe and really just tragic situation.
What should the state be doing?
We need a critical access for every single person who is on the streets and is homeless. They need to be offered a hotel room, private hotel room, right away. Because that gives them an opportunity to be in a safe space, to have their own bathroom, to not be exposed to the virus themselves, to have that safe place to be while pandemic is unfolding and continues to unfold. And we need them to think about the long term and actually both building and subsidizing housing for people who are homeless.
How are they moving along on this plan to put people in hotel rooms? Has that been developed or has there been a halt in that?
The city has been moving way too slow on that front. You know, right now, the majority of people who are in hotel rooms are people who have already tested positive or who are symptomatic with COVID-19. But we're still seeing congregate shelters, for the most part, with the same level of density that they've had.
Has there been an outbreak in the shelters?
Absolutely. There are, at this point, over 700 cases across the shelter system. So we know it's a problem. It's already a problem, and we're already in emergency mode, and we need the city to act much more quickly.
Coalition for the Homeless Policy Director Giselle Routhier. In his news conference today, Governor Cuomo also announced that 335 New Yorkers had died of coronavirus in the last 24 hours. New York City has 156,713 cases and 17,215 deaths. Meanwhile, May 1st, the day rent is due for most New York City tenants, is fast approaching. 68% of New York City residents are renters. It's the second month since the lockdown sent millions to the unemployment line. Activists using the hashtag #CancelRent have been organizing a rent strike in the city and nationwide, demanding the government take action. Yesterday, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of Queens spoke out in favor of a plan to allow small landlords to skip mortgage payments in return for forgiving rents.
Suspend mortgage payments for 3 months. Tack that on to the end of the repayment period. So let's say you have a 10-year mortgage. Just suspend it for 3 months and make it a 10-year and 3-month mortgage so that you just make 3 additional payments at the very end. Now, what that allows you to do is it opens up the time and you can take that suspension time to cancel rent, to make sure that we cancel the rent of any tenants in that building. They don't have to pay it back and it does not create an additional financial liability on that landlord. So that's a very broad stroke way. Of course, there are other issues that we'll have to address, like property taxes and other issues. But if you have been collecting rent up until this time, then it also means that we can figure this out. We can figure it out. But right now, the question is not, can we get it done? It's not that it's impossible to do. And it's not that we can't do it. It's that we lack enough politicians with the political will to actually help people who are tenants and to actually help people who are mom and pop landlords. We've passed almost about 4 relief, different pieces of legislation related to coronavirus relief. And you wouldn't know that, would you? Because those 4 pieces of legislation are not being felt by everyday people as much as they need to be. It's being overwhelmingly slanted to the wealthy. It's being overwhelmingly slanted to the people who need help the least. And we need to turn that around to make sure that we are actually focused in not compromising on making sure that we are delivering results on the people who need it the most. And so with that,
Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of Queens. On Thursday, the city's Rent Guidelines Board will be meeting to discuss a report on mortgages in the city. Mayor Bill de Blasio has suggested the board freeze rents for the year. And jails remain petri dishes for the coronavirus outbreak. On Monday, 2 people at Fishkill Correctional Facility died of coronavirus, bringing the total to 9 prisoners who died of the illness in New York prisons. Activists have been calling for the release of elderly prisoners, people with minor parole violations, and those nearing release to stem the outbreak. Meanwhile, supporters of jailed citizen journalist Ramsey Orta are calling for his release. They say prison guards have threatened to give him COVID-19 and have deprived him of soap, showers, tissue, and cleaning supplies for his cell. In the summer of 2014, Ramsey Orta filmed the arrest and chokehold death of Eric Garner on Staten Island. The video captures Garner gasping, "I can't breathe," as Officer Daniel Pantalone put Garner in a chokehold. Orta says police began targeting him for harassment from that day on. Orta was arrested on a warrant and held in Rikers Island, where he says guards put rat poison in food served to the prisoners. This reporter spoke with Orta in September 2016 on the program Let Them Talk.
You felt that they adulterated your food with rat poison.
Yes.
What made you think that?
I mean, you know, I pretty much never heard it, rat poisoning being in prison food. And then, you know, when it just so happened to be in the house I was being housed in, and I didn't feel like it was a coincidence.
What was it you found? Where did you find the rat poison?
In the meatloaf, and I was serving the food. And knew something was wrong when other inmates started, like, throwing up blood and going to the bathroom and things like that.
Really? Did you eat any of that meatloaf or something? No. Right. And what was found? Was the meatloaf inspected afterwards? Or
yes.
It was?
Yes.
Can you tell me about how that occurred? How?
Me and a couple other people basically saved portions of it and got it into the right hands, and the Department of Health ran lab reports, I mean lab tests, and the reports came back, it was rat poison.
And did you, was there a complaint filed with the, with yes. Rikers Island? And what was the response? Was there anything in the way of a response?
Not that I know of. Hmm.
Ramsey Orta appearing on this reporter's program, Let Them Talk, in 2016. 2 days after this interview, Orta began a four-year prison term. He's due for release in July. His supporters say he was innocent of the charges that put him behind bars, but pleaded guilty to avoid trial. Supporters are asking the public to phone Governor Cuomo at 518-474-8390 and politely demand Orta's release. That's Governor Cuomo at 518-474-8390 and politely demand Orta's release. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. In national news, President Trump is expected to sign a five-page executive order under the Defense Production Act to compel meat processing plants to remain open amid the coronavirus pandemic. The closures came as the mostly immigrant minimum wage workers have been falling sick to the coronavirus. Tyson Foods, which employs roughly 100,000 workers, closed its pork plants last week to test workers for the virus. Smithfield, a pork processing plant in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, also closed its plants, its doors, due to the pandemic. That's raised fears of a shortage of pork and beef in American supermarkets. By signing the order, Trump will declare these plants as part of the critical infrastructure of the United States. But as the federal government takes action to protect the supply of food to grocery shelves, hunger has been growing across the nation and in New York. Governor Cuomo addressed the issue on Monday.
We're seeing a tremendous demand in food banks, which is predictable in some ways. But the numbers are very, very high, and we need to address it. 200% increase in Westchester, 100% increase in New York City, 40% on Long Island, 40 to 60% across upstate New York. So we're going to commit $25 million for emergency funding for those food banks. I'm also asking philanthropies to help. Many philanthropies said they wanted to help and step up. This is a, I would say, the number one thing they can do to help. And if they're interested, please let us know, and we'll supplement the state funding with philanthropies funding. We also have an issue across upstate where, because the markets are so roiled, some farm cooperatives are actually dumping milk because the market can't consume it. This is just total waste to me. We have people downstate who need food. We have farmers upstate who can't sell their product. We have to put those two things together. It's just common sense, but we have to make that marriage between product upstate and need downstate. And we're going to launch a special initiative to do that. We're also immediately, to stop this dumping of milk, going to work with industries in our state who can use the milk and get it to people who need it. So I want to thank these companies who will be working with us to buy the excess milk, yogurt, cheese, sour cream, cream cheese, and then we'll give it to the food banks that are downstate.
Andy Fisher is the former executive director of the Community Food Security Coalition and the author of Big Hunger, the unholy alliance between corporate America and anti-hunger groups. He says the demand for food is exposing America's deeply rooted hunger problem.
It's not just $25 million from New York State. I mean, the federal government has put $4 billion into food banks since this pandemic started, mostly in the form of food, but also some cash. To me, it just points out the underlying inequities in our society and that we have to go down this path. There's a saying that charity is injustice. Charity is what you do when there is no justice. We're seeing that in spades now. Food banks were serving 40 million people before the pandemic started. And now you're seeing doubling in New York counties and 70% nationally. People are stretched thin. People don't have much resilience in their budgets. They're having to go to the food banks. It's just indicative of the state of inequality in our society.
How do food banks get their food, and how does that affect the supply chain problems we've been hearing about?
In a typical year, food banks will get about 20% of their food supply from the federal government, from commodity programs, probably about 50%, 40-50% from either retailers or processors. In other words, kind of it's the waste of the corporate food system. And the rest, they're either purchasing or they're getting from individual food drives. It would stand to reason that if there's no food in the grocery stores, there's no surplus to be giving to food banks, other than what we're seeing of the milk being dumped and the fields being plowed under and that kind of...
Milk in New York, the governor was talking about milk being dumped.
Yeah, we have a food supply that's bifurcated. The restaurants and institutions on one side and to grocery stores on the other, and it's not a very adaptable. You're finding that the restaurant side of things, the institution side of things, are struggling with what to do with their surplus. We're also seeing problems with labor shortages with a meatpacking plant. That's one of the issues, but also, you know, I'm hearing about it in the fields out in Florida and California. If farmers don't have a market, that zucchini or lettuce or whatever it is that they're having to plow under, then they're not going to pay the labor to pick it because there's nowhere for it to go. So it rots in the field.
Why isn't this food being delivered to people as part of these food banks?
I think USDA has been slow to move in that direction for whatever reasons. You want to infer about USDA's capacity. And it's also, there's now a $3 billion order that USDA has made to actually purchase boxes of food from farmers and from food processors and to get those into food pantries and to the like. So it's moving that direction, but it's been slow.
Is this a Trump thing or something you would have just expected?
It's a lot of different things. We have a high degree of monopolization, so that it's very concentrated. So there's not a lot of resilience in the system. So when a large meatpacking plant goes down, it's going to affect the country. It's a Trump thing in the sense of you have an incompetent administration. But I think the flip side of this, before the pandemic, USDA bought billions and billions of dollars of food to put into what's called tariff mitigation because of the tariffs that they were putting on the Chinese and others. Chinese were not buying our products. So there's all this food that the farmers were not able to sell. So the Trump administration was buying that food and giving it to food banks. You're seeing the same thing now. From my perspective, the Trump administration would rather put that money into food banks than into food stamps and into the SNAP program, because to them, it's much more politically palatable to be giving charity than to be giving out an entitlement program, increasing an entitlement program like SNAP.
Is there ultimately any difference?
Absolutely. Food stamps or SNAP is an entitlement. It's a right. If you qualify for the program, and there are certain work eligibility requirements, unfortunately now, you're entitled to that program. Charity, no one's entitled to. It's a gift. You cannot claim charity. You can claim a right, and you can claim SNAP.
Well, that's what's at the heart of government food policy in the United States.
It's been an abdication of our role of providing for the food security of the public and putting it back onto the private sector. But it's also been the public sector buying into that kind of charity approach as well, which is where this band-aid of commodity food is going.
Andy Fisher is author of Big Hunger, The Unholy Alliance Between Corporate America and Anti-Hunger Groups. And finally, last week was Earth Week, but 50 years ago, there was Earth Day. It all started here in New York, and WBAI was there, and so was reporter Neil Conan.
First Earth Day, I was on the staff of WBAI News, and we were down in Union Square broadcasting live. I think we had feeds also that same day from Philadelphia and later from the West Coast, too, but as it all started, given the time differences, it all started from Union Square.
And what was it like in Union Square that day?
I remember it was a beautiful day. We set up in our usual expansive card table with the microphones and a mixer and a feed back to the studios on 39th Street. There was a stage set up at the north end, about middle of the park, and we were just south of it. And I remember I was looking north and spent the day doing the broadcast and got completely sunburned on the left side of my face, on the west side of my face.
Who spoke? Who was there? Who did you interview?
It was not so much interviews. It was a series of speakers and performers. The focus very much at that time at the Union Square was the Hudson River cleanup. Presenters included Pete Seeger, who, of course, had just started Clearwater, focused around his sloop, Clearwater. There was the Hudson River Fishermen's Association was speaking. Odetta was the other performer, I remember. She was great.
Was it a large crowd?
It was a pretty good crowd. It was a pretty good crowd. There was a lot of energy about it, I remember, feeling that, before that day, I was questioning whether there was enough energy in the environmental movement, such as it was then. And after that day, I came away utterly convinced that this was going to be one of the major issues of our lives.
What was it about the event that gave you that feeling?
It was the crowd, really. It was the enthusiasm of people for the event and their conviction that, you know, this wasn't a, you know, a partisan issue in any way. It was just their utter conviction that this was the only way to go. This was the way to go, that we had to clean up our waters and clean up our air and look out for the environment around us.
The environment, environmentalism is a tremendously partisan issue, divides the country.
It is, yes.
Did you see that in those days? Did you feel that it was going to happen?
No. In those days, I mean, you have to remember that, you know, it was the Nixon administration, you know, guilty of many things, but in terms of the environment, not so bad. And Republicans really backed some of the important clean air and clean water legislation in Washington. So this was not a partisan issue in those days. In those days, you know, people in the Republican Party actually believed in science.
If this was the first Earth Day today, not the 50th, I'd be doing a story about crowds of people screaming and cursing at each other across the street. It's interesting that you didn't have that kind of thing at all.
It was much more of a, you know, a be-in atmosphere.
It had that hippie feel to it.
Oh, indeed. You know, again, the Hudson River Fishermen's Association was not a hippie organization.
Yeah.
They were pretty serious people. Bill Schechner was there with me. He was also on the staff of the news department at the time.
Did you have to find a payphone and make a report, or did you come in, or did you have a line there? How did you do it?
You know, since we were in Union Square, it was just, you know, take the subway a couple of stops north.
Right. Where was BAI studio back then?
30 East 39th Street between Madison and Park.
Neil Conan is a radio reporter with Hawaii Public Radio. As a WBAI reporter, he was at the first Earth Day 50 years ago this week. And that's some of the news for Tuesday, April 28th, 2020. The news is produced by Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.